You are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
And we're going to talk about, I was going to say Beauty and the Beast, but it's not really that. It's the Beast and the Beast. There are two beasts in Revelation 13, and we're going to talk about the first one of them tonight. But let's begin by reading the passage. Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 13, or 10. John writes, he says, "Then I stood in the sand on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his ten horns, ten crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon, who gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?' And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue this for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life, of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints." Here in Revelation, John has provided an extended intermission to what we're reading now. Revelation 10, verses 1 through 11, verse 14, this entire section, Revelation 10 to 11, 14, is an extended intermission that leads from the sixth trumpet judgment to the seventh trumpet judgment. Big intermission is between. And then after that, Revelation 11, verses 15 to 19, we see that John introduces the seventh trumpet judgment, finally. And so what we expect next is then the seven bowl judgments. But we don't actually get the seven bowl judgments yet. We get yet another extended intermission. This intermission runs from Revelation 12 all the way through three chapters to the end of Revelation 14. And just to give you a little bit of a spoiler alert, the bowl judgments don't happen until Revelation 15. In the chronology of Revelation. So we won't get to them next week or the week after. It's going to take a few more weeks. The intermission will stretch on. This intermission provides us with insightful and figurative descriptions of the people and events, things that will go on during the tribulation period, especially the second half of the tribulation period. During this intermission, John first introduced us to a woman in Revelation 12, verses 1 to 17, a woman who represents the people of God, or specifically the nation of Israel during the tribulation. It also introduced us to a child who is the Messiah that the people of God in Israel would bring into the world, Jesus Christ. And then we are introduced to this great dragon, right? This dragon creature. And this, of course, represents Satan. And these three characters are portrayed in this big epic drama that begins in the Garden of Eden at the beginning and arches over all of redemptive history and lands squarely in the tribulation period when this great struggle between good and evil, God and Satan and his people and his Messiah, comes to an apex in the tribulation period. But after this dramatic description of this woman, this child, and this dragon, we now get another figurative and symbolic description of a beast. Two beasts, actually. We're going to look at one of them tonight. The other one that is mentioned second, we'll look at that beast next week. These two beasts are presented by John. This word beast describes something of not just an animal, but something that is vicious, carnivorous, a mean and terrible beast. Some commentaries call this section of Scripture the two monsters, the sea monster and the earth monster, because the word beast has this kind of monster-like quality to it, something that is beastly and vicious, ravenous. The first beast is described in Revelation 13, 1 through 10. The second beast, Revelation 13, 11 to 18. Tonight, let's take a look at the first beast. The first beast will be a satanically empowered world leader. A satanically empowered world leader. We can draw that from this passage, Revelation 13, 1. Then John said, I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads, 10 horns, and on his horns, 10 crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name was written. John tells us that this beast rose up out of the sea. Now that's interesting to analyze because the second beast, he says, comes up out of the earth. And he sees these two different sources for these two different beasts. We don't get any kind of interpretation from John telling us what the sea represents. So we cannot be dogmatic to say the sea symbolizes X or Y. Although in this case, we can make an educated guess that is not going too far. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 15 says, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits, and this is a vision that John's going to see later in the book of Revelation, but with many similar details. There's going to be a beast with these heads. It's going to reemerge again from the sea. So here he says, this is the sea, the waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And then Daniel 7, verses 2 through 3, a similar prophecy in the book of Daniel, speaks of four great beasts that came up from the sea, each different from the other. And if you read farther in that passage, you'll see that it's referring to the sea of humanity. And so it is possible, though we can't be for sure, that there is some symbology here of this beastly person arising from the sea of humanity, from mankind, from human people, and the governments and civilizations of the world. If that's the case, we can move on and talk about some more details here. This beast has seven heads and seven or 10 horns. I'm giving you a picture. I'm not always eager to do this. I'm giving you a picture of this tonight of what this beast might have looked like. We don't actually know. We couldn't draw it perfectly. Where were these horns? Because I'm always bothered. The perfectionist in me is always bothered by this image. There are seven heads, but where do you put the 10 horns? After you're done putting seven horns, one on each head, you have three left over. Does one of the heads have an extra horn? Does one have a few extra horns? I don't know. But it's possible, like this particular graphic you see, maybe there are horns going down the ridge of the neck or something. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The perfectionist in me is bothered by that. But it has seven heads and ten horns. And on these ten horns are ten crowns. What's interesting here about this description is that it resembles the dragon's description in Revelation 12. That dragon had seven heads and ten horns. And in Revelation 13:2, just the very next verse that we're going to see, John tells us that this beast will derive his power from the dragon. And so you see this direct, not just figurative, correspondence between the dragon and the beast. And there's a strong indication here that this is a human, beastly figure who is going to be working in direct concert with Satan himself. This thing that Satan will do, he will give this figure his influence. He will give this figure his governmental position, and he will give him his political power. Whatever he has, he will get it from Satan himself. This beast of a person will serve as Satan's ultimate human alternative to God's Messiah. There are many antichrist figures in history, people that rise up and say things to substitute for Christ and draw people towards themselves in the name of Satan, or people who undermine the cause of Christ through doctrine and behavior and practice. This is called the spirit of antichrist. There are antichrists in the world from the first century until today. But this will be the ultimate antichrist. Again, if you're thinking along computer game analogy terms, there's all the little bosses along the way, but at the end is the big one, who somehow has all the qualities of the little ones bundled into one big ghastly form. And this is that antichrist. The seven heads represent seven major world empires. We talked about that previously. I won't belabor that tonight, and we get that from a lot of the material in the book of Daniel. These would be Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the Antichrist's future kingdom. Some call it the reemergence of Rome. These pagan empires have been Satan's primary platform for attempting to derail God's program and God's people. He's been doing this throughout history. These empires are a primary platform through which he has attempted to do that. In fact, if you study the book of Daniel, you will know that during the Greece Empire, there was a man named Antiochus Epiphanes who rose up and did many of the very things that the Antichrist will do. So these ten horns. What about the ten horns? The seven heads represent seven empires. These ten horns represent, and you can find this also in Revelation 17:12. We'll get there later. We'll talk about these people more later. Revelation 17:12. These represent ten rulers who will govern in Christ, or the Antichrist kingdom. Satan gives the power and authority to this beastly character. He then delegates ruling authority and power to these ten figures. Now, there has been, at least when I was a kid, I remember listening to prophecy seminars and hearing this in books, that these ten leaders are the European Confederacy, the European Union. And when Great Britain joined the European Union, that was just the cherry on top. all the pieces were coming into place for Jesus to come back and the Antichrist to appear, and maybe the Chancellor of Germany would be, and then people, there's all these surmisings about this. I mean, Brexit has kind of done a little bit of a blow to that theory right now. Maybe Great Britain will come back into the picture again. We don't know. It's possible, I'm going to just conjecture my own possible interpretation, that the world itself will be divided into 10 zones of some kind, and these 10 figures will rule their cut of the world. All we know is that there will be 10 rulers of high-ranking authority that will have some rulership in the Antichrist kingdom, and he will give them those positions. Think of it this way. Christ himself said, as the Messiah, the true Christ, when he comes, what is he going to do for his 12 disciples? He will give them each places of rulership in the kingdom. He will divide some things up for them. This is the Antichrist doing a similar thing in some form or another. On the heads of this beast, John then sees a blasphemous name written. Maybe it's emblazoned on their crown, or maybe it's tattooed on their face, or whatever the case, there is a blasphemous name that is written. He doesn't tell us what that blasphemous name is specifically. He just says it was there, and he probably doesn't even want to say what it was. The word blasphemy means saying or representing another person, their reputation, in a denigrating, disrespectful, and derogatory way. So this Antichrist and his political deputies under rulers will govern the world with a programmatic, blatant disrespect for God and for Christ. In particular, John points out that they will have a blatant hatred for God, his tabernacle, most likely referring to the worship center right there in Jerusalem that the Antichrist will come into and desecrate halfway through the tribulation, and his loyal followers, even those angels and or deceased believers who are now in heaven at that point. He will still be wreaking his revenge on those who've gone on to heaven. His hatred will be so strong for anyone or anything, dead or alive, associated with Christ and God's kingdom, that he will govern in a way that expresses that strong revulsion. His outspoken revulsion for God will be a prominent feature of his governing style and his political policies. But the heart and center of everything he says and does as a leader. Verse 2 says, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." And so from this description, we see that the beast looked like a stealthy. When it says it looked like a leopard, the idea is that would be the base body, the body. You start with a leopard's body, and then you pop on it a lion's head, and then you put on it bear's feet. So massive paws and a stealthy body and a vicious face. This is the ferocious description that he saw. And this description is nearly identical to the beast that, or the beasts that Daniel describes in Daniel chapter 7. And in that vision, those beasts refer to, respectively, Babylon, Persia, and Greece, and qualities of those nations. Now, what makes those nations stand out is that they, in particular, seriously persecuted the Jewish people. Roman Empire didn't do that to the same degree, for instance. These are empires with a serious persecution of the Jewish people. And here in this beast, all of these three vicious empires are combined. One commentator says this: the picture of all three animals combines qualities of all of Israel's former oppressors: craft, lust for blood, and vicious energy. Hosea 13, 7 through 8 is a fascinating statement in the Old Testament prophets. The Lord is describing how he will judge his people. Here's what the prophet Hosea says: I will be to them, his people, like a lion, like a leopard by the road. I will lurk, I will meet them like a bear deprived of her cubs. I will tear open their rib cage, and there I will devour them like a lion. The wild beast shall tear them. That is not a prophecy of this beast. He's not talking about the beast in Revelation. The point being, these three animal creatures are prophetic favorites for talking about the kind of treatment that Israel receives for rebelling against the Lord. And this treatment is handed to them through pagan empires. Then this prophecy goes on to say in Revelation 13, I saw one of this beast's heads as if it had been mortally wounded. So one of the seven heads, as if it had been mortally wounded, and this deadly wound was healed. The world marveled and followed the beast, so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So John sees one of the heads. They all have a name on them that's blasphemous, but one of them in particular has a wound, and it's described as a mortal, deadly wound, and it's really hard to know what he saw here. Maybe it was a big gash or something, a bleeding wound of some kind, but whatever it was the kind of wound that looked like it could have killed him. It's just not clear. Was this actually a mortal wound? Did he actually die and come back to life? Or did he just have a close scrape with death and have a wound that nearly killed him, that looked like he was about to die and anybody else would have died from this wound, but he didn't die? Now, we're not really sure. But what we do know is it's going to be such a serious situation that he is able to leverage this wound and perhaps death and his recovery or perhaps resurrection from it to get everyone to be in shock and awe and say, well, if that can happen to him, then who can ever fight against him? We are going to follow you. And we are going to worship you because of that wound. Think about it. If someone today stepped onto the world stage and, for all to see, had a scrape with death, and it was such a scrape that you thought they died, maybe they did, and they came back to life, that would definitely arrest people's attention and get them thinking, and they would maybe not be the most religious people, but would say, I think we need to pay attention to this person. In fact, isn't that one of the most compelling things about the Messiah? That he died and that he rose again? It is. And so we know that Jesus Christ died and rose again by the power of the Holy Spirit. But this is not so clear. But it looks like maybe that's what happened, and Satan is going to leverage this deception through the Antichrist. People will acknowledge this rival to the resurrected Lamb, and he will persuade the world to follow him in amazement and worship him. Then Revelation 13 and verse 5 says, and he was given. So the first four verses do more to describe this beast. Now we get a explanation of some of what he's going to do, his actions. He was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, given authority to continue for 42 months, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. So there's a lot here to look at this beast and to study and think about. But can you tell me what it is that is standing out to John the most? There's a lot that's capturing his attention. The number of heads, the number of horns, the number of crowns, the wound. But what is it that stands out to him most? The blasphemous name, the blasphemous mouth, the blasphemous agenda and approach and style of this person. Most of the world will follow the Antichrist, and they will do it willingly because of his apparent ability to cheat death. Something else, though, is going to happen. The world is going to follow him, but about halfway through, or just prior to halfway through, just before the second 42 months of the seven-year period, that would be half of 7 years, the Antichrist is going to come out in a blasphemous way that will be blatant. And he's going to open his mouth and say blasphemous things. And this is what seems to be a reference to what we call elsewhere the abomination of desolations that Daniel speaks about in the book of Daniel. And in Daniel chapter 7, for instance, a lot is said about this. Let me read Daniel 7:25 for you. Daniel 7:25. He, this beast, will speak pompous, arrogant words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. And of course, John is going to say soon what should be the patience and perseverance of these saints. But there is a very strong connection here between these prophecies. And there's that time and times and half a time mentioned. Mathematically, it's the same as 42 months. So you can see that the strong connections here are very hard to miss or mistake. And so this beast, for the second half of this tribulation period, will not just be amassing a government and all of these things and getting people to follow him. He will come out in a blasphemous way that is blatant. Now, this in some ways seems to be a recapitulation of what was described in Revelation 12 and near the end of Revelation 12, verses 13 to the end of verse 17. When the dragon goes on a rampage against the saints, against the people of God in the second half of the tribulation, this appears to be the human side of this. That is the behind-the-scenes visualization of Satan on his rampage. Here we see the Antichrist as the human mouthpiece for this rampage and leader of this rampage. And it says in verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. That has already been stated. We'll just repeat, the majority of the world will be swayed by him and will follow him at this point. But then John adds this. Whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world? And here this additional reference, whose names have been not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, is mentioned. This is one, and we've talked about this before, of seven times that John refers to this book of life or book of the Lamb, book of life of the Lamb in the book of Revelation. This reference to the book of life deserves some brief attention because John brings it up yet again. And he's not done bringing it up. He's going to bring it up in chapter 17, in chapter 20 a couple of times, and in chapter 21. It refers to, best as we can tell, a written record or registry of some kind. A record that is recorded, written, with names of all those who will be in God's eternal kingdom. It's a pre-registration, so to speak, by God, a permanent record. This record is irreversible. It is permanent from beginning to end of time. This phrase, from the foundation of the world, means from back before when the world was started. That's the idea. Before even creation was set into motion, this record was firm. It indicates that the redemptive status of every believer in history is an established fact before or after it actually happens in real time, as far as God is concerned. And at no time in history, past, present, or future, is it possible for a believer to have their name removed from this record. There are times that God says, I won't remove your name from this book. But that doesn't mean that he could, in theory. It's not a taunt or that kind of thing. It's saying, that's not how this book operates. You're either in it or you're not. You don't go in and come out. In and out. There's no deleting that actually goes on. It also means that those who are not in this book are not and never have been and never will be entered. There's no way to work your way onto this registry. There's no way to change God's mind about this record. So whether or not a person will be redeemed by God is a matter of permanent public record in heaven. You go down to City Hall in Manhattan, they still have registry books for the people who get married and have their marriage certificates down there. You go down there, and you'd think they would have a sophisticated computer system, and apparently they have some kind of system. But after they do all that, they pull out this big, hardbound book, and they open it up, and they write your name in it and put a date on it. A registry. What this is describing is that kind of thing. Only the records were entered before the world was ever made. There's a certainty here. Now, on the flip side of this certainty is that no matter what happens, no matter how masterful Satan's strategy becomes on this planet Earth, he can never alter what the records are in heaven. He can't change that, no matter how hard he works down here. When he gets people to follow the beast, he will not have won anything by his machinations. It won't be like, because he was so great at what he did, he got people that he wouldn't have gotten otherwise. No, he simply got what he was assigned to get from the beginning of time. He didn't actually advance anything. That's a little deflating from Satan's side of things for all the effort that's going to go into this campaign. That leads then to how John, this certainty, leads to John's pastoral comments at the end. Revelation 13, 9 through 10. He says, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. Now, when you listen to that and you hear that, what do you think? What do you remember that sounds like that? Remember earlier in the book of Revelation, in the letters to the seven churches in Asia Minor, all of them ended with Jesus saying, he who has an ear, let him hear. What the Spirit says to the churches. Now, here, it says, he who has an ear, let him hear. But it doesn't say what the Spirit says to the churches. That is missing. It's not there. Which is one line of evidence that gives possible credence to the idea that, yes, The church is being spoken to directly about things pertaining to it in the church's letters of Revelation 2 through 3. But during this tribulation presentation that takes up the majority of the book of Revelation, the church is not in view, but rather Jewish people who are being converted or other people being saved, but not as the church. And so words like the saints or these kind of things, the martyrs, are used, but the church is not referenced. And here would be an example in which you would expect them to say what the Spirit says to the church, but there's no continuation of that. And so that's just one reason. People say, so why do we think the church is not in the tribulation? This would be just one of those reasons. And then it says, he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And there is some very lively discussion, for good reason, about this particular verse and how it should be translated. And I've done some work to kind of look at all that. And it seems that the English Standard Version may actually, the ESV, may come closest to capturing what's being said here. Something like this. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he will go. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. The idea being, this will be a very traumatic time. There will be no time like this in history. The kind of trauma and vicious persecution that will go on. This is a beast that epitomizes all the vicious empires against God's people, all in one. This is the epitome Antichrist. This is Satan's last big masterful campaign. And what is being said here is the people who are going to worship him are going to worship him, and the people who are going to follow God are going to follow God. So, if you happen to be a saint, someone who is refusing to follow the Antichrist, and you're being persecuted by him, just accept the fact, if he's going to put you in prison, he's going to put you in prison. If he's going to martyr you, he's going to martyr you. That's just how it is. He said, that sounds fatalistic, but then John says, this is the patience and the faith of the saints. The idea being, just as long as you can accept this is a period of 42 months, give or take, depending how long you last in those 42 months, if you're being persecuted. It's a time that will be terrible, but it will pass. What's going to happen is going to happen, and there's nothing you can do to change that. So just endure to the end, and it will be okay. That's the idea. Let's just make things very simple. It's going to be a chaotic and terrible time. But if you're going to suffer, you're going to suffer. If you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed. It's just the way it is. The people who are going to follow him are going to follow him because their names have never been written in the Lamb's Book of Life. They've never been there, so it's going to be like this. It's just the way it is. That is a statement that in that tribulation period of time is given by the Spirit of God to help those persecuted to endure. And if it doesn't help you to endure, then meditate on it, because that's what it's supposed to do. Now, since the people and events of Revelation 13, and we'll talk about beast number 2 next Wednesday, Lord willing, if these events occur in the future in the tribulation, to the saints of the tribulation, not to the church today, and this is speaking about the Antichrist, not any government leader that we're underneath right now in the world anywhere, then what good is this information to us? I'm going to offer three possible takeaways for us tonight that I hope can be an encouragement to you. First of all, Satan is most successful when he mimics God's plans most closely. Think this through. Satan has tried a lot of things, right? In the Garden of Eden, he accomplished something when he got mankind to fall. The way he did that was what? He took the words of God and he kind of used them and twisted them. Now, technically, God never showed up like a snake and he didn't crawl around in a tree and he didn't go to any deceptive methods like that. Satan added his own approach, but he did twist the words of God. Throughout history, Satan has tried all kinds of different things, right? We talked about that. We've talked about the people who, the nation of Egypt trying to kill the babies, Herod trying to kill the babies. We've talked about other world empires persecuting the people of God. We've talked about the Pharisees being snakes and serpents and trying to trip Jesus up with his words and these kind of things. We know that today there are many antichrists going out into the world. Satan is trying to get people to think they're following the Messiah when they're not. In the Islamic world, there are people who think they've found the prophet or they have found the Messiah and it's not Jesus. He's tried a lot of things. He works through temptation and lusts and sinful desires and bad friends and materialism and all of these, so many strategies. But when it all comes down to it, the plan that actually gets the entire world in sync, just about the entire world, behind him and gets them to literally just worship him, is when he actually decides to do as closely as possible what God himself has always intended to do as a master strategy. It's like he stops tiptoeing around. He stops trying different random variations and themes on things he sees God do. And he decides maybe this idea of just uniting everybody together around a Messiah who dies and comes back and all of, maybe that's the way to do it. You delegate it to certain people and maybe that's the way to do it. And to empower him, just like that, straight up. The closest Satan ever comes to replicating God's master plan is the Antichrist and what happens in the tribulation. Even walking into the temple itself and saying, "Worship me." He comes as close as he can, and he is actually as close to successful as he can be when he does that. That doesn't actually raise Satan's credibility at all in any of our minds, right? But what it does actually do is it raises our view of the credibility and the masterful wisdom of our God. God has actually planned to do this before he even made the world. This isn't something he had to sit down and try to tinker around with and figure out and through history and time tweak his plan until he finally came up with a good one that would win. No, this has been his plan from the beginning. It's just simply playing out, literally as recorded in the heavenly registers. He's just following the rules. Satan has been spending his whole created existence just about trying to figure out how to outfox God, and the closest he ever comes to it is at the very end when he actually tries to do the exact same thing. It's like sitting down to play a master chess player, and you get the second move. Master chess player moves first, and then you do something that tries to throw him off. You do something random over here, and he wins. So you play again, same thing. Finally, you decide, wait, what if I mirror him? He moves that guy, I move that guy. He moves his bishop, I'll move my exact same bishop the same way. We're going to lock horns, then there's going to be a battle at the end. Why don't I just do literally what he does, basically? And that's kind of what this is. But he still loses. Because God's plan is still superior. And it is that superiority of God's plan that gives Satan whatever success he actually has from a strategic standpoint in the end by trying to actually mimic that. But it's still not going to be good enough. Trying to copy will not overcome. So, I think there's a little bit of a warning in here for us today. Some of of Satan's most effective strategies with you are going to be those that most closely mimic things that might be from God. Doesn't the New Testament also teach this? Don't marvel, because Satan can be transformed into an angel of light. It's when he presents himself in a way that actually seems like it's from God that he's most effective. We have to be wise about that. Second of all, another lesson we can take away from this tonight, I think, is that our suffering makes most sense in light of Christ's suffering. I emphasized that this registry in heaven is permanent. The names written in it are permanent, and the names not written in it are permanent. That's a permanent fact. They're not going to get in it, and they never will. And you might say, that's not fatalistic. Isn't that unfair? And what does that do to the domino effect of my decision? John is not even beginning to try to understand that. He's just telling us there is a record, and that record is permanent, and things play out that way, as written, in heaven, on earth. But if you think that's unfair or fatalistic, then you have to realize how John says it. The book of life of what? The Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. It's not just that the records have been permanently and indelibly there. It's that that record is based upon something else. The death of Jesus Christ. Is it fatalistic to say that Christ was determined to die for us before the world was even made? That is not a negative thing in my book. That is an assuring fact. Everything is based on that. The records are rooted in that. That registry is based upon not so much my decisions, your decisions, their decisions, and the capricious nature of human history as we experience it. But everything runs through not our choices, but through Christ's choice to be slain. If anything is not fair, if anyone can cry fatalism, it's Christ. Because to make the world was to require him to die. And he did it. And that was a settled fact before not even it ever happened, but before the worlds were even made. Remember how I said at the beginning of this study, we're going to take a chronological, pastoral, and what? Christ-centered approach to understanding this book. And you have to keep a Christ-centered approach. For us, it gives us great assurance. If you have believed on Christ as your Lamb, as your substitute, your Savior, your Messiah, your name is permanently, indelibly written in that book. And guess what? That record is as unquestioned as the fact that Christ would die for that to be the case. Not because I decided, I didn't decide, or all. It's because Christ died. That's the fact. And I rest in that. As crazy as things are today, you can lose your Social Security card. You can drop your birth certificate in the sewer on your way to the DMV. You can lose your data, whatever the case might be. Tax season is coming up. We're going to have to get all of our numbers and our documents. You can try to cross a border and lose your passport and whatever. There is one record that is permanent, and that is your salvation. And it's not based upon you. It's based upon Christ. History is crazy. The tribulation is going to be the craziest time ever. But these things are not going to change. And even Satan's master strategies are not going to change that record one pen stroke. Finally, God's sovereignty over our suffering encourages perseverance. Though we are not living through the tribulation, we can still suffer varying levels of persecution for following Christ. See, we can use the future experiences of these people as an example to decipher how should I handle my suffering today. Learn from the future. Just from the past. I mean, not just from the past. Learn from the future as well. And we can just go through varying levels of persecution for following Christ, even from government leaders and policies. That is one way that we suffer as people, right? Now, we have to be very careful to recognize we're not coming anywhere close to anything like this today. And yes, my political post being banned from Facebook is just, if we complained about that to people in the first century, or we complain about that to people in the tribulation, they'll look at us and say, what are you talking about? That is not persecution. And we act like it is. It's not even the beginning of persecution. But there are ways that we can suffer persecution. And right now, as an American Christian, I have to be honest to recognize there are people in the world, in places in the world, who are suffering persecution much closer to the tribulation style of persecution than I will ever experience. And that is real to them right now. And all of us, whatever levels of persecution we endure, we can look at this and realize, wait a minute, what is going to happen is going to happen, but it doesn't change my status. God still wins, and there will be a time limit. Jesus Christ himself understands the challenge of persecution. In the garden before his betrayal, what did he pray? Lord, if it's possible to take this away, please take this cup of suffering away. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours. The Gospels continually refer to his persecution, his crucifixion, as his hour of temptation, his hour of trial. It's a fixed period of time that you go into and you come out of, and it identifies you with Christ. And this is how we get perseverance and faith for suffering, by realizing it's fixed, there's a time limit, and I can't be damaged in any meaningful way. Don't try to suffer. Don't ask for it. Pray to avoid it. But don't fight and rebel and go crazy if it comes to you and there's nothing you can do about it. Accept it for the glory of God, and he will guide you.